from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Through the luminous imagery of her best-selling fiction, writer and novelist Isabel Allende has transported readers to her native Chile and to an imagined world. So well, in fact, that a photographer once came to take photographs of a house that never really existed, except in the writer's mind. Now, in a new memoir, Isabel Allende throws open her doors of memory and imagination to the invented country of nostalgia, of childhood, of the exile's mind, and of Isabel Allende in America. Tonight on Point, voyaging with novelist Isabel Allende to her invented country. We began with the National Catholic Bishops' Conference in St. Louis. A year after announcing new measures to combat the sexual abuse of children by priests, the bishops find themselves again in rough waters. Michael Paulson is a reporter with the Boston Globe. I asked him about the mood at the conference today.
The mood is somewhat gloomy. It's been a very difficult week for the Catholic bishops of the United States. As you probably know, just yesterday, the day before the bishops' meeting began, the Bishop of Phoenix resigned after being charged in a fatal hit-and-run car accident. And the weekend had been dominated by headlines about a battle between the head of the bishops' National Review Board and the Archbishop of Los Angeles, who was indignant that the review board head, Governor Frank Keating, had referred to bishops as members of La Cosa Nostra.
So it has not been a good run-up to the meeting. And, of course, over all this hangs still the big question of child sexual abuse in the Catholic Church. It was a year ago that the Charter for the Protection of Children was drawn up. What progress has the Catholic Church made in addressing this overriding issue, Michael Paulson?
You know, that's a matter of some dispute. The bishops are arguing that they've made tremendous progress. Cardinal George of Chicago said this afternoon that the bishops made two central promises last year. One was to have a national policy for protecting children, and the other was to remove from the priesthood, or at least from ministry, any priest who had ever abused a minor. He says they accomplished both of those things, and they have not gotten enough credit for that. But if you talk to the victim advocacy groups and the lay groups that are hanging out around the margins of this conference, they are far more critical. They believe that the bishops also promised a new attitude toward the public, a new posture of transparency and openness, and that they have not demonstrated that over the last year.
Let's look at some of the details. The document that was promulgated last year called for the permanent removal from ministry of any priest who had been accused of sexually abusing a minor. Has that happened? Is that happening?
That has happened. We did see as many as 400 priests around the country lose their jobs over the last year as a result of this new policy. These were priests who had been still working despite having allegations against them that they had abused minors. So, yeah, the bishops have, by and large, fulfilled that part of their promise. Now, many of those cases still have to be adjudicated. The priests have been removed temporarily as the diocese attempt to determine whether or not the allegations are credible.
The bishops last year also established this 13-member panel of prominent lay Catholics that was, until his resignation, led by Governor Frank Keating of Oklahoma, the National Review Board. That board is to be auditing compliance with the new policies. Are they effectively doing that? Is that audit being permitted by individual bishops?
Yeah, the National Review Board has a number of charges. One of them, as you say, is to audit the bishops to determine whether they're complying with their policy. That audit is underway, and most bishops are said to be complying. The more controversial elements are that the National Review Board is supposed to come up with two reports, one of which would look at the scope of abuse of minors by priests in this country. It would be the first effort by the church to come up with a number of how many priests abused how many minors. And the second is a report on the causes of the crisis, which obviously is a matter of significant debate. The review board has run into a number of hurdles in getting the bishops to comply with the study of the scope of the crisis, with a number of bishops, particularly from California, initially balking at turning over statistics and data.
And this is what led Frank Keating to throw down the La Cosa Nostra charge, I guess, because the bishops, he asserted, were not opening up.
That's correct. Now, just today, the bishops of California have put out a statement saying that they've changed their mind and they're now going to cooperate. But the National Review Board says that a small minority of bishops are still declining to do so.
Is it possible that the bishops' conference could or would instruct those bishops to comply? Do they have that authority?
Well, that's what the victim support groups and the lay advocacy groups are looking for. They would like Bishop Wilton Gregory, who's the president of the Bishops' Conference, to clearly instruct every bishop to comply. But no, the Bishops' Conference does not have that power. That power rests with Rome. The National Review Board has said that it plans to publicly identify at some point any bishops who do not cooperate, and they're hoping to use the possibility of public shame to force cooperation.
And what about the Review Board's inquiry into causes and context for the scandal over sexual abuse? What progress has been made there, Michael?
Well, that's a very interesting subject. That effort is being led by a Washington attorney named Robert Bennett, who you may recall for having represented President Clinton.
Yes.
He has been interviewing bishops and cardinals and other key players in the scandal in a kind of prosecutorial way, and he's promising to have a report by January of this coming year. He says that it will look at all of the big issues that people believe may have contributed to the scandal and the crisis.
Causes and context sounds like about as big a framework as one could choose, and potentially explosive. You write, Michael Paulson, that the bishops, at least some of the bishops, are interested in convening a plenary council. What is that? What would it do? What's the precedent?
It's an interesting kind of gathering that we have not seen in any of our lifetimes. These gatherings took place with some frequency in the 19th century in this country. The last one was in 1884 in Baltimore. And it's a gathering of all of the bishops of a country, along with non-voting representatives of priests, lay people, theologians, university presidents, cathedral rectors. So a kind of broad cross-section of the church that gets together to discuss the state of the church in a particular country, in this case the United States. The bishops have set aside tomorrow for a day of prayer and reflection that they say will be aimed at attempting to figure out whether holding a plenary council would be a good idea. And they're going to talk about the issues that they might talk about at such a council, including the role of lay people, the role of priests and bishops, the reason for a decline in participation in sacraments by Catholics in this country. They're saying it would be at least 3 years before they could pull together a plenary council in this country.
And who participates in it? What would its potential impact be? Would it be different than a meeting of bishops in St. Louis?
Its scope would be much broader than a meeting of bishops, and its agenda would be broader. Participation would also be broader, but somewhat limited. It's the participants are spelled out by canon law, and the only people who can vote are bishops, but lay people and priests would be allowed to participate in some kind of consultative fashion.
So here's the American Catholic Church still in deep here. Michael Paulson, stepping back for a moment, how would you describe where the church is today in the kind of arc of crisis that it has been wading through for the last year and more?
You know, I think a lot of bishops had hoped that the crisis was easing over the last several months, particularly in the wake of the resignation of Cardinal Law in Boston. But over the last week, the crisis has once again intensified, both because of Governor Keating's assertion that some bishops were behaving like mobsters, and then because a bishop was forced to resign after being arrested for striking someone with his car and then leaving the scene. So there's certainly a sense among many observers of the church that the credibility of the church's leaders, bishops, has been seriously harmed.
And remains harmed.
And remains harmed.
Michael Paulson, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Paulson is a reporter with the Boston Globe, part of the Globe team that won a Pulitzer Prize for its coverage of the sexual abuse scandal in the Catholic Church, and is co-author of Betrayal, The Crisis in the Catholic Church. He spoke with us from St. Louis, Missouri. Twenty years ago, Isabel Allende stormed onto the literary scene with her earthy, ethereal novel, The House of Spirits, in which she chronicled the story of four generations of a Chilean family. Now the acclaimed novelist turns to vivid documentary to share her growing up in and exile from her beloved Chilean homeland. In a new memoir, My Invented Country, she writes of the Allende familia, of male machismo, her fiery adolescence, and the military coup of 1973, which overthrew her father's cousin, Salvador Allende, the first socialist president of Chile. And she acknowledges that an exile's homeland is, in fact, an act of imagination. Word by word, Isabel Allende writes, I have created the person I am and the invented country in which I live. Tonight on Point, Isabel Allende and her invented country. How does a writer, an exile, come home? Have you left lives and worlds behind as an immigrant, as an exile, as a rootless American? Do you know the invented country? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from San Francisco, California, is writer and best-selling novelist Isabel Allende. Her new memoir is My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile. Good evening and welcome, Isabel Allende.
Good evening, Tom. How are you?
Very well, and so happy to have you on. I have to say, in these times of so much rough stuff going on, it was really a delight to pick up your book and just float off into it. You have invented a country for me in here, Isabel Allende, and I'm grateful for it.
Thank you.
It's just a terrific read. What a lively, lively mind. You, not to mention what a way with words, and you start right off with the notion of two 9/11s. Not many Americans who don't have a Chilean connection somewhere will understand what you're talking about there. The two 9/11s in your life, Isabel Allende.
The first one was a Tuesday, September 11th, 1973, in the morning. And that was the day of the military coup in Chile that ended a long tradition of democracy in my country and was sponsored by the CIA, by Kissinger and Nixon. And the second Tuesday, September 11th, in the morning, was the terrorist attack on the World Trade Center. In the first one, I lost my country, Chile. And in the second one, I think I gained a country because I felt for the first time that I belonged in the United States. I was not an alien anymore.
You have such a tremendous body of work. Of course, the House of Spirits, and then right on down through Love and Shadows, Evaluna, The Stories of Evaluna, The Infinite Plan, Paula, Aphrodite, Daughters of Fortune, City of the Beasts. At this point, Isabel Allende, how do you see yourself as a North American, as a North American writer, as a South American, as a South American writer, or are you the all-American?
I call myself an American because that's what my passport verifies, but also because it includes North and South America. You know, in the United States, Americans very arrogantly think that they are the only Americans. We also are Americans, the people from the South. And here in California, I have everything, my family, my grandchildren, my books, my friends. But my memories are from Chile. So in a way, I think that I have been able to make a home here in the United States, but carrying with me everything that I have brought. I have a sort of extended mixed family, and it works. You know, to be bicultural, it's great.
And it's such a rollicking story you tell of everything in Chile, of your life in the United States. They seem somehow now to fit together. But when you talk about your invented country, what exactly do you mean? Is it Chile as it is? Is it what you've had to invent to carry with you in your years of exile and uprootedness?
Tom, I haven't lived in Chile for 27 years. Mm-hmm. And I think I have a country that is frozen in the 70s. That's the country I carry in my memory and my heart. And when I go back to Chile and I confront it with a real country 27 years later, of course it has changed. Many things have changed. And we had 17 years of a brutal dictatorship that really changed the character of the country and changed many, many things. So I don't quite recognize it when I go, but I still feel at home. And when I write, I realize that I draw from the well of memories that has to do with Chile. That's the only place in my heart that I don't have to research. If I write, for example, about a mango, I would have to go to the market and buy a mango and smell the mango and try the mango to know how to write about it. But if I talk about a Chilean peach, I don't have to have it in my hands. I know exactly how a Chilean peach smells and tastes.
At least as remembered, 27 years on, as recreated by the exile. I want to come back and talk with you about nostalgia, Isabel Allende, and the way it works in a writer's mind and the way that it works in your work. We are talking tonight with novelist, Chilean, exile, American, Isabel Allende, about her remarkable life and her new book, My Invented Country. You can join the conversation. How does a writer come home? How does a writer carry home? Have you left lives and worlds behind as an immigrant, as an exile, as a rootless American? Is nostalgia the root system of displaced people? You can join us at 1-800-423. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with novelist, Chilean exile American Isabel Allende about her remarkable life and her new book, her new memoir, My Invented Country. You can join the conversation. Have you visited Isabel Allende's invented country through her fiction? And what did you find there? Do you recognize your country in Isabel Allende's invented country, your America, your Latin America, your Chile? And do you remember that other 9/11, Chile's 9/11/73, when Salvador Allende was vanquished in a coup and Pinochet's military moved in? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Isabel Allende, I wonder if you'd be good enough to read just a bit to us from the introduction to your new memoir that takes us back into writing and your creation of the invented country, and a bit of your relationship with the United States. Something from page 11 there, 11, if you've got it.
Yeah.
Great.
But first, Tom, let me tell you that I'm not an exile anymore. I am an immigrant, and it's very different. An exile is a person who cannot return to his or her country, and is always looking back and never quite unpacks. An immigrant is a person who comes to another place by his or her own will, and is always looking at the future.
We want to talk about exactly how that happened. We had the stamp of the exile on so much of your work, but you've made a transition. We want to look at it. Maybe this reading will begin to help take us in.
Okay. I write as a constant exercise in longing. I have been an outsider nearly all my life, a circumstance I accept because I have no alternative. Several times I have found it necessary to pull up stakes and leave everything behind in order to begin life anew elsewhere. I have been a pilgrim along more roads than I care to remember. From saying goodbye so often, my roots have dried up, and I have had to grow others, which, lacking a geography to sink into, have taken hold in my memory. But be careful. Minotaurs lie in wait in the labyrinth of memory. Until only a short time ago, if someone had asked me where I am from, I would have answered without much thought, nowhere, or Latin America, or maybe, in my heart, I'm Chilean. Today, however, I say I am an American, not simply because that's what my passport verifies, or because that word includes all of America from north to south, or because my husband, my son, my grandchildren, most of my friends, my books, and my home are in Northern California, but because a terrorist attack destroyed the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, and starting with that instant, many things have changed.
Isabel Allende reading from her new memoir, My Invented Country. Isabel, there's so much we want to get into in Chile. Your descriptions are so rich. Time and again, knock the socks off the critics. Miami Herald calls your writing lyrical, mystical, ribald, funny. The Boston Globe says Allende is a unique and staggering storyteller. And I can attest that it's true, even when it's memoir and not fiction. But first, I'm so interested in what exactly it was about 9/11/2001 that made the United States your country. I was struck later on in the book, you write at one point, we Chileans are enchanted by states of emergency. Now, with your personal story, that has all kinds of resonance to it. Are you enchanted by post 9/11/2001 America?
No. No, I don't like America after 9/11 because with the excuse of safety, people have given up many of their rights.
And yet it's the very time in which you say you've embraced this country, you've come to feel that it is yours.
Yeah, but for another reason, Tom, and that is because for the first time I felt that there was a sense among Americans, a sense of vulnerability, the feeling that life is not a safe thing and that the world is not a safe place, a feeling that most people have all over the world except here. And when I felt that, and when I could grieve with everybody else, I felt that I belonged. I really embraced the grieving and the mourning, not because I like emergencies, but because I felt at home. I had lived before in those a circumstance that is very similar.
And with that, you let us go to Chile. I'm hearing connections all through here to that invented country. You describe how Chileans love to grieve and mourn. But it might be helpful first if you would take us back.
But also we like to laugh.
Yes, we've got it both ways. It's an amazing combination. I want to talk about it. But give us the quick history for our listeners of how you came from the girl in Chile to be an exile. It was, you know, your father's cousin, Salvador Allende. So I guess that's your second cousin once removed.
Yeah, well, no, in Chile he would be my uncle.
Okay, in Chilean terms, your uncle.
Yeah. He's my uncle.
You're right.
But that was not the reason why I left the country. I left the country because I couldn't live in a dictatorship, and I didn't like what was going on in Chile, and I felt very threatened. So when we had the dictatorship in Chile in 1973, I stayed for a while because I thought I could keep a low profile and it would be over soon. But then I realized that it was not going to be over so soon, and I left. And I left and I went to Venezuela with the idea that I would stay there for a few months and go back as soon as we would have democracy again in Chile. As it happened, the dictatorship lasted 17 years. I lived in Venezuela 13 years as an exile. And then in 1987, I came to the United States in a book tour. I met a man, fell in love, and decided to come and spend some time with him and get him out of my system. That was 16 years ago, and I'm still here. I married the guy to get a green card.
And it worked anyway.
And so I became an immigrant, and the feeling is totally different. Being an immigrant in a country makes you part of that country, makes you want to plant roots there. You want your children to belong there.
Yeah.
It's not the same case when you are planning to go back. I'm not planning to go back.
Of course. But we love that from that kind of situation of relative security, the way you're looking back on Chile. I wish you'd take us just quickly through some of these characteristics of your invented country of Chile. Let me throw some out and get your response to, if you can paint a bit of a word picture for us here. You write so wonderfully about class, social class in Chile. This is something I'm not sure Americans will see. How does it work?
It's like a cake of many layers. You're born in a social class and you stay there unless something miraculous happens. There's no permeability. Now there is a little bit more. But before, if you were the daughter of a gardener, you would remain there forever. It's not like in a country like Venezuela or the United States, countries made of immigrants, where social mobility is so wonderful that you can really go up and down in the social scale.
And when Chileans meet you, right, that they have this thing called situating, what you call the equivalent of what dogs do when they sniff each other's hindquarters, and it goes on right away. What are the markers that Chileans look for to establish class?
Well, accent, the way you speak, the way, of course, you dress and you carry yourself. There is something that is very difficult to describe, but you can tell immediately. Of course, the last name.
Which often has the mother's name and father's name, so that you can see the entire lineage right there on display.
Of course, of course. And immediately you know if you are related to those people or not.
Right.
Because everybody is sort of related.
Take us to another front, envy. You say that Chileans have abundant envy. Why? What?
Because it's a small country, and we have the feeling that there are not enough opportunities for everybody. So if somebody makes it, we get really angry. And especially if it's a woman, especially in the field of literature.
Oh, watch out. Exiled by the women.
Yeah, watch out if a woman succeeds in anything.
Right.
And so it's hard.
And then there's this great continent, and I hope you'll read something about it here for us, of machismo. This is a section that, as an American man, it blew me away. You go on and on about machismo. Machismo, beloved grandfather, you call him machista. Talk about how Mexican women wait hand and foot, Chilean women wait hand and foot on Chilean men. I wish you'd read something for us, maybe from page 52 there. You allude to machismo throughout Latin America, Mexico, but then you turn to Chile and describe its unique character there. I wonder if you could give us some of that.
I will read, but let me make a point.
Please.
There is machismo in the United States also.
Well, sure.
Don't think that you're exempt because you're not.
Okay, you've got the X-ray turned on.
Yeah. Let me start my reading.
Please.
There is no secret about machismo in Mexico. It's in their rancheras, the country ballads, but among us it is much more veiled, though no less injurious. Sociologists have traced the causes back to the Spanish conquest, but since male dominance is a world problem, its roots must be much more ancient, and it isn't fair to blame only the Spaniards. At any rate, I will repeat what I have read about it. The Araucano Indians were polygamous and treated women very badly. They would abandon them and their children and leave as a group to look for new hunting grounds, where they took new women and had more children, whom they left in turn. The mothers took care of their offspring as best they could, a custom that in a way persists in the psyche of our people. Chilean women tend to accept, though not forgive, abandonment by their men because they think of it as an endemic ill, something inherent in the male nature. As for the Spanish conquistadors, very few of them brought women with them, so they coupled with Indian women, whom they valued far less than a horse. From these unequal unions were born humiliated daughters who would themselves be raped as women, and sons who feared and admired the soldier father, bad-tempered, unjust, master of all rights, including those of life and death. As those sons grew up, they identified with their fathers, never with the conquered race of the mother. Some conquistadors had as many as 30 concubines, not counting the women they raped and immediately abandoned. The Inquisition railed against the Araucanos for their polygamous customs, but overlooked the harems of captive Indian women accompanying the Spaniards. More mestizo children meant more subjects for the crown of Spain and more souls for the Christian religion. From those violent embraces come our peoples, and to this day men act as if they were on horseback, surveying the world from on high, giving orders, conquering. As a theory, that isn't half bad, is it?
The question mark, leaving room for the invented country, but it sounds like a lot of fact there as well in Isabel Allende's new memoir of her own life, of the life of her native country, Chile, of her invented country, the life in mind of the one-time exile, now immigrant. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Juan is calling from Waltham, Massachusetts. Hi, Juan. You're on the air.
Hello, good night, and thank you for taking my call.
Good
and
to have you.
Buenas noches, señor Allende.
Buenas noches.
Well, I'm also an immigrant in the U.S. I work here in high technology, so
okay.
Probably I don't share a lot of the characteristics of the or the frame that people put a lot of the immigrants, especially from Mexico and Central America.
You're working in high tech, and it's a different picture than the picking lettuce.
Absolutely,
yeah.
It's a completely different picture. But I also have. I have to echo a lot of the comments that Mrs. Allende has made, especially regarding that inventive contract that one's create on his or her own mind after many years of living in a country like the U.S., which is a great place to live, but definitely has its disadvantages too.
Juan,
right?
do you find yourself floating into nostalgic memories of Mexico, of inventing a Mexico in your mind, as Isabel Allende has done in this book?
Yes, one invents its own country, especially when the changes that occur in a country happen and you're not there. I was in the U.S. already when the first democratic change in 70-some years happened in Mexico, and that was quite an astonishment for me to see that actually happened, but I wasn't even there. And it's very difficult to cope with memories, but at the same time, it's also very difficult to live in between two different worlds, which sometimes don't feel real or are not real for a person like an immigrant.
Isabel Allende, it sounds as though Juan is right on your wavelength. Does it mean that, Juan, that you still know that country of origin, or is it really some large part fable as the years go on?
Well, I think that the country does exist. Deep in the roots of the country, I think that nothing changes, but at the same time, the facade that one sees changes a lot.
Isabel, what do you think?
The same. I think that there are some characteristics that are there, like hidden or underground. For example, I talk a lot about my book, How I Miss the fact that before people in Chile were never ostentatious. The worst crime in Chile would be to show off, to be arrogant. And now I see that that has changed. I see that people who don't have much show off as if they had more. And they pretend to be rich because people have become very materialistic. But I think that that's in Santiago. And if you go to the south or to the north, if you go to the countryside among fishermen and miners and those people, you find again that sort of humble, unassuming, non-ostentatious characteristic that was so charming in Chile.
Juan,
so if we dig, it's still there.
It's still there, as Juan says, as you say, in the roots. Juan, let me ask you, you live among Americans.
Yes.
And I wonder, as you observe them, and I'll put the same question to Isabel Allende, but do you see this notion of an invented country is so interesting? I mean, even when we live in the country of our birth, of one's birth, we all kind of invent our understanding. Do you think Americans live in an invented country, even when they live in the United States?
Yeah, first of all, I think that the U.S. is not one single country. It's many different countries, whether you it could be by region or by social class, which Mrs. Allende referred to earlier. But to a certain degree, yes, I do think that some Americans in the American in general, I should say, invents his or her own country quite often.
Juan, thank you so much for your call.
Well, thank you very much.
Isabel,
Tom, this is a very large country, so it is very difficult to portray it as one entity, the homogeneous entities, many countries within a country, many nations within a nation.
But even if it were one, are you suggesting that everyone somehow invents their country?
I think that people have a sort of stereotype of what the country is. For example, most Americans, especially now with all this patriotic thing that is going on, people have an image of the United States that has to do with the American dream and the Statue of Liberty and the flag and all that kind of stuff, which is not real. Nothing of that is real. Those are symbols. Those are things that represent certain things. But really, what the country is, it's very complex, and we don't have a real clear idea. We have invented our own country. We do all the time.
And that invention creates a place of comfort or at least refuge in the mind.
A place where we feel that we belong.
And when you touch that invented country, the one in your mind, not the one where you live in San Francisco, is it North American? Is it Chilean? Is it Allendean?
It's a country that I have in my head. It's a country where the country of my books, where my characters dwell, where the stories come from, the country of memory. It has a lot to do with the United States because I've lived here 16 years, a lot to do with Venezuela, where I lived 13 years, and of course the rest is Chile. Mm.
Isabel Allende, please stand by. We're talking tonight with novelist, Chilean, exile now immigrant, American Isabel Allende, about her remarkable life and her new book, My Invented Country. You can join the conversation. How does a writer, an exile, an immigrant, come home, create homeland? Have you left lives and worlds behind as an immigrant, as an exile, as a rootless American? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is on... I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with novelist, Chilean, one-time exile, now immigrant, now American, Isabel Allende, about her remarkable life and her new book, My Invented Country. You can join the conversation. Have you visited Isabel Allende's invented country through her fiction, and what did you find there? Do you live in your own invented country? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Mudafa is calling from Dorchester, Massachusetts. Hi, Mudafa. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing, sir?
Great, thanks.
I have just a question to the lady. I wonder if her experience in freedom and justice back in Chile, and I do know what Pinochet did to the Chileans. I am from Iraq as well, and I do understand the conflict between freedom and dictatorship. But yet, I came to the United States, and I felt that the concept of freedom is not the fulfillment I was looking for as much as it's a sort of different kind of control, but over people's mind.
Mudafa, we've got it. Turn your radio down a little bit and let Isabel Allende respond. Isabel.
He's talking about, I didn't quite get it, but I think
Mudafa is from Iraq. He's from Iraq. Yeah. He came to the United States, and he said he found freedom, but it wasn't really what he expected, and it perhaps wasn't as free as he had dreamt.
Well, we should start by defining what freedom is. Freedom maybe is not the right to do whatever we want, because we have to live in a community and we have to share with other people the space and the time. But I feel that there is a lot of freedom in the United States, and that freedom is at this point endangered, and we have to take care of it. You know, freedom is something that we only appreciate when we lose it. It's like health. And that happened very much in Chile. When we had a dictatorship in Chile and our freedom was gone, then we realized how much we had lost.
I wonder if you might read a bit more for us, because there's a passage here, page 196, where you really speak both to this freedom and to your concerns about it and where it's led you. And I guess we should say in setting this up that you observe early in the book that part of your inspiration to write the book was when your grandson, Alejandro, in the way of young children, what did he said something about you've got 3 years, Grandma.
I was, he saw me scrutinizing the map of my wrinkles in the mirror, and he slapped me in the back and said, "Don't worry, Grandma, you're going to live at least 3 more years."
Oh, thanks a lot.
And that is what started the book, because I started thinking, where and how do I want to live those years?
So with that background, Isabelina, if you could read about your sense of freedom in the United States and that invented country.
I want to add that the United States has treated me very well. It has allowed me to be myself, or any version of self it has occurred to me to create. The entire world passes through San Francisco, each person carrying his or her cargo of memories and hopes. This city is filled with foreigners. I'm not an exception. In the streets you hear 1,000 tongues. Temples are raised for all denominations, and the scent of food from the most remote points of the world fills the air. Few people are born here. Most are strangers in paradise, as I am. It doesn't matter to anyone who I am or what I do. No one watches me or judges me. They leave me in peace. The negative side of that is that if I drop dead in the street, no one will notice. But in the end, that is a cheap price to pay for liberty. The price I would pay in Chile would be high indeed, because there diversity is not as yet appreciated. In California, the only thing that isn't tolerated is intolerance. My grandson Alejandro's observation about the 3 years I have left to live forces me to ask myself whether I want to live them in the United States or return to Chile. I don't know the answer. Frankly, I doubt that I would leave my house in California. I visit Chile once or twice a year, and when I arrive, a lot of people seem happy to see me, though I think they are even happier when I leave, including my mother, who lives in fear that her daughter will do something foolish, for example, appear on television talking about abortion. I feel great for a few days, but after 2 or 3 weeks, I begin to miss tofu and green tea. This book has helped me understand that I am not obligated to make a decision. I can have one foot in Chile and another here. That's why we have planes, and I am not among those who are afraid to fly because of terrorism. I have a fatalistic attitude. No one dies 1 minute before or 1 minute after the prescribed time. For the moment, California is my home, and Chile is the land of my nostalgia. My heart isn't divided. It has merely grown larger. I can live and write everywhere, anywhere. Every book contributes to the completion of that country inside my head, as my grandchildren call it. In the slow practice of writing, I have fought with my demons and obsessions. I have explored the corners of memory. I have dredged up stories and people from oblivion. I have stolen others' lives, and from all this raw material, I have constructed a land that I call my country. That is where I come from.
Isabella Allende reading from her memoir, My Invented Country. Juan is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Hi, Juan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My own observation is a little different, and I'm not sure if Ms. Allende has any comment on it. My own background is my parents are both natives from Lima, Peru. I was born and raised in Connecticut, educated here in the States. I'm a professional working in Boston. I haven't really been convinced to myself that I am either assimilated into the American culture per se, or that if I were to go to Peru, I would be really assimilated into that culture.
So do you feel somehow lost between the two, Juan? Is that what you're saying?
Yes. I think maybe it's the fact that I am somewhat different here in the States. Physically, I probably have an appearance of being a mestizo, and I'm sure Ms. Allende knows what that means. Mm-hmm. And in Peruvian society, being a mestizo means you are treated differently than you would be if you appear to be of European extraction.
Well, Juan, let us take it right there and stay with us. Isabel Allende, it's from the sound of Juan's voice, you may have more experience with this than he. What's your counsel to Juan?
Well, he was born here. I'm amazed that he doesn't feel American. This is a country where people from all colors can feel that they somehow belong. But I do understand what he means. I don't think he would fit in Peru at all. And he would probably fit more here. Because he would never be able to understand the class system, to comply with racism, and with how he would be put down many times because of the color of his skin or whatever. And I think that he was born in a country where he has had the opportunity to become whatever he wants, and he wouldn't be able to do that in Lima.
Juan, what do you think?
Well, while it is true that I've been able to become what I wanted to here in the States, and I do have the education, but I'm still, even here in the States, in liberal Massachusetts or in the liberal Northeast, relatively, there is still there are assumptions made based on the color of my skin and whether I should be fulfilling a certain role, and certainly not the role where I am.
So maybe an invented country is not entirely sufficient for you. You're looking at your day-to-day reality and not feeling fully...
Right. Well, I'm not convinced by it.
The truth is that to be born a white male is much more convenient in this country, but you are not. So I think that given the life that you have and the person you are, you found a life here. And I would try to keep part of the language and be bicultural as much as possible, but don't dream of going back to Peru and find there your place, because it's not there.
Juan, I think Isabel Allende's book may be written almost precisely
almost
for you.
Almost for him.
Almost for you personally. I hope you'll pick it up. Let's get one more call. Solange is calling from Concord, Massachusetts. Hi, Solange. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Just great. Make it quick, Solange. Our time is short.
Okay. I just wanted to say that I've just bought the book, Isabel, and I unfortunately have only read the first few pages, but your title just grabbed me. My parents are dreamers, dreaming of another country that they weren't born in, but their parents were.
Which country?
And I live. My mother's parents were English, and my father's parents were French, but they were born in Argentina, and I dreamed always of England and France as an invented country. And then we moved from Argentina to Peru when I was two, so Argentina was also an invented country for me. And then I went and lived in England and in France, and the invented countries became real, and they were very different to the invented country.
Solange, we have to leave it right there because our time is so short. But, you know, Isabel Allende, it occurs to me as I hear from the Juans, from Solange, you're addressing a large population of Americans who are going north and south, back and forth, and may need to invent this country for themselves.
You know, we all, in the United States, we all come from some other place. We may be two or three generations here, but we all have some background from another place. I am amazed how this book has been received in the United States, because I never expected it to be successful. I thought, who cares about Chile? But really, what people find in the book is their own roots.
And maybe your then exile and now immigration is a story that they share. Maybe you're marking a trail here, Isabel Allende. With that, we are out of time, but it's just been great having you. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you,
Tom. So much for joining us.
Thank you.
Isabel Allende is author of the new memoir, My Invented Country, A Nostalgic Journey Through Chile. In a moment, controversy over a leaked report at the EPA. This is On Point. A draft of a soon-to-be-published EPA report on the state of the environment has been heavily edited by the White House in what is perhaps the closing salvo to Christy Todd Whitman's beleaguered tenure as EPA administrator. An internal EPA memo describing the edits was leaked to the New York Times yesterday. The memo protests administration edits for excluding references to several studies which concluded that global warming is caused by humans and is dangerous to the planet. New York Times environmental reporter Andrew Revkin spoke with us earlier today about the whittled-down report.
The White House tried very hard to take out most references in the report that erred on the side of certainty as far as the risks posed by rising temperatures, and also anything that seemed to point to a human element in what's causing the warming. And in its place, repeatedly, the White House edit put in phrases that essentially stress all the uncertainties in the science. And when the EPA staff got the edited version back from the White House, they saw such big changes. And as they said in today's story, they said basically this doesn't reflect the scientific consensus on climate change. They said we have three choices. We can either accept it and just take the heat, as is sometimes done in Washington. We could go back to the White House and say, this doesn't work. Come on, let's do something else. Or we could just take out the climate section almost entirely. So what's left is just pretty much a bare-bones disclaimer that we're not going to deal with climate change in this particular report, even though we deal with all these other issues in the environment. The State of the Environment report had a structure where each section, whether it's water or air, is introduced by a summary statement. And there was this huge change that took place between it going from the EPA to the White House and back. That was one of the key things that got people concerned at the agency. The summary statement originally for the climate section was simply this phrase, climate change has global consequences for human health and the environment. When it came back, that was scored out, and in its place there was a bunch of text that starts like this. The complexity of the Earth system and the interconnections among its components make it a scientific challenge to document change, diagnose its causes, and develop useful projections of how natural variability and human actions may affect the global environment in the future. Quite a different set of statements. In the EPA staff's memos to each other about what to do about this, they said a couple of telling things that essentially reveal their lack of confidence in what resulted. They said, this report, quote, no longer accurately represents the scientific consensus on climate change, unquote. And they also said the consequences of this, if they let the revision stand, which was one of the options that they considered, was the following, quote, EPA will take responsibility and severe criticism from the science and environmental communities for poorly representing the science, unquote. So there was clearly a lack of confidence at the agency in the editing that was done to their work once it got to the White House. This is how things work. Anything has to go through the political filter before it comes out of an administration, whether it's a climate document or an economic document or whatever. But what people within the agency and on the outside are saying is the level of change here and the sort of our way or the highway aspects of some of the documentation were startling. And the EPA staff clearly felt they just couldn't do it.
Andrew Revkin of the New York Times. To read the original EPA report, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.